Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Margie Davenport. She's an exercise physiologist and professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology, Sport and Recreation at the University of Alberta. And this conversation about updated research guidelines and recommendations for exercise during pregnancy and postpartum is so needed. So I'm really excited. I hope that you share this episode out. Now, Dr. Davenport was the chair of the 2019 Canadian Guideline for Physical Activity Through Pregnancy and the 2025 Canadian Guideline for Physical Activity, Sedentary Behavior, and Sleep throughout the first year of postpartum. And this work led to the development of Get Active Questionnaire for Pregnancy, Get Active Questionnaire for Postpartum, and the Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology, American College of Sports Medicine, pre- and postnatal exercise specialization. Now, Dr. Davenport has published more than 200 manuscripts related to physical activity and sport during preconception, pregnancy, and the postpartum period. Over the last decade, she has worked with a number of national and international organizations, including FIFA, the Women's Tennis Association, the World Health Organization, International Olympic Committee, Sport Canada, and the Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology and the American College of Sports Medicine to support physical activity during and following pregnancy. Again, this is a much needed conversation with the actual research guidelines to back it up. So please, again, if you have anyone telling you anything different or their opinion or what they've heard, share this episode along. Margie, thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm really excited for this conversation because even, you know, myself being on social media, showing my workouts throughout pregnancy, there's so many questions, concerns, comments, people who are worried about hurting the baby or anything. So I just think this conversation, the newer research that you are doing, which is incredible, is so needed. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to bust a few myths today.
Yeah. And so from what I understand, you are some sort of guru in the field of pregnancy and postpartum, especially in Canada. You have been so involved in helping develop Canadian guidelines in the pregnancy and postpartum space. So can you just briefly explain what you do and how you're involved at that level?
Sure. So I'm a professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology, Sport and Recreation at the University of Alberta. So I'm based in Edmonton, Canada. It's a little bit chilly today. But I've been working in the field of exercise and pregnancy for the last 20 years. So what you see is actually just the reflection of my age. And we have a really, really strong community of researchers who work in this particular area. So I led the development of the 2019 Canadian Guideline for Physical Activity Throughout Pregnancy and the 2025 Canadian Guideline for Physical Activity, Sedentary Behavior, and Sleep Throughout the First Year Postpartum. So we've had a lot of really exciting new releases over the last couple of years. And the goal of these guidelines is really to start to dispel myths and misconceptions that we've had about exercise during and following pregnancy.
That is so needed. And it's really exciting to have updated guidelines and to continue to see these evolve and change as the research continues to change. So, you know, the hope is then that all the OBs understand and are keeping up with it, because sometimes I still hear from my friends who are pregnant of like, oh, I was told totally healthy pregnancy, not to lift over 20 pounds. And you know, there, I'm still hearing today some of these recommendations being laid out. So can you talk about what the current recommendation for pregnancy, especially in a healthy pregnancy, is with when it comes to physical activity? Now, as we're talking about movement and exercise during pregnancy, postpartum, I cannot neglect to say what prenatals I took during preconception, into throughout my pregnancy, and a year postpartum. And now I'm switching to more of like their women's health line, but it is needed. Needed is like elite when it comes to prenatals, because
What most people want to do is take one or two prenatals. They don't want to take a ton, and I get it. However, when we're talking about optimal dosing so that you're actually getting the nutrients needed for preconception and throughout pregnancy to support a growing baby, we need more than just one to two little pills. And this is why Needed also has a powder formula. So if you don't want to take like eight pills at a time, I totally get it. I used to break them up. So I would do four in the morning, four in the afternoon. However, if you don't want to do that, you could do their powder. So you can make smoothies every day. You could put it into coffee, whatever you need to kind of help to get this into you. It's so essential. And this is why I took Needed, is because it offers products that are formulated by experts in women's health and are backed by clinical insight from the collective of over 4,000 practitioners. Their product offers the forms of the nutrients your body can actually use, and it's dosed at the optimal, not bare minimum levels. And this is what's key and what makes Needed really elite. They go above and beyond with third-party testing, testing every batch to ensure their safest products, and they really, I mean, they change formulations as needed. They update things according to the research, and it's who I truly trust in my body and has really helped to support my journey. So if you have not checked them out yet, head over to thisisneeded.com, use code OPTIMAL, and you get 20% off your first order. That's thisisneeded.com and use code OPTIMAL to get 20% off your first order. Okay, let's get back in.
So we have really strong global consensus that we encourage engaging in at least 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity. So brisk walk, going for a run across three or more days of the week. We do encourage both aerobic and resistance training. So raising your heart rate through a walk or a run, but also lifting weights as well, which is essential. We also encourage engaging in pelvic floor muscle training. So that's something that we don't talk about nearly enough. And then when we go into the postpartum period, I would say that postpartum is a little bit more of a newer area that we're really talking about. Up until, you know, maybe the last 5 years, we just thought about postpartum as you go from being pregnant to all of a sudden non-pregnant, you get screened at 6 weeks postpartum, and then after that, you're cleared to do whatever you want to. But I think we've finally come to the place where we recognize that postpartum, you do need rehabilitation to be able to resume physical activity. And so the current guidelines for Canada, which took 30 years to update, surprisingly, 20 years, we recommend resuming physical activity shortly after birth and gradually increasing towards at least 120 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity spread over four more days of the week, and including both aerobic and resistance training. So lots of exciting times.
And by when should you be like coming into that 120 minutes per week?
Mm-hmm. So everybody's journey is going to be really quite different. So I already mentioned that 6 week postpartum mark, and that was kind of a traditional point where everybody would be cleared. But the fact of the matter is that some people are ready to resume physical activity and get close to that 120 minutes very early after delivery. And for some of us, it actually takes a lot longer. We're not ready to resume physical activity or begin it for the first time until much closer to that, you know, 1 year or even longer mark. And so it's quite individualized between everybody, because everybody's journey is going to be so different.
And I think that's so important because, like you mentioned, for the longest time, it was the, okay, 6 week mark, you get
for
your
everyone.
You get your screening. Yeah. And if there's nothing really crazy going on, or if you don't have any major contraindications, okay, just go back to what you're doing or go back into your physical activity. But we have to recognize that each one of these deliveries and each one of these births is different. And I think that that's where these guidelines are just head and shoulders above where kind of some of the current practices are. Something that I also love to see is that there are recommendations on sleep and sedentary time. And what was the last one that's in there?
Pelvic floor training.
Pelvic floor training. Oh, yes. Of course, I forgot it. And it's something that is always always seems forgotten. Pelvic floor training. So can you talk about some of the guidelines when it might relate to sleep, especially for new parents who are like, okay, you're giving me recommendations on sleep? Really?
So with the postpartum guideline, before we actually put it together, we consulted, we did surveys, but also individual interviews with women to find out what they wanted in the guideline. And there were two key things they wanted to talk about. They wanted to talk about their mental health, and they wanted to talk about sleep. So anybody who has a newborn or knows anybody with a newborn, those are turbulent times, especially when we talk about sleep. But we've had this sort of longstanding societal belief that you really just have to suffer through. I'm somebody who, my kids did not sleep at all, and they didn't sleep for a very long time. Anybody who wanted to talk to me about sleep in the early postpartum period, I probably would not have said many nice words to them. But at some point in your postpartum journey, most of us get to the point where we want to do something about it. And there are lots of different options. But we did want to take a look at whether or not there were specific options, especially related to physical activity, that could help to support better sleep overall. So if you look at the Canadian guideline, we actually don't put a specific duration. And the reason is that we don't actually see a specific duration that's going to optimize your overall health. Mm-hmm. What we did see is that being physically active in the postpartum period, and we're just talking about even going for, you know, a gentle walk to get a bit of movement, that it was associated with better sleep quality. So you're not going to sleep longer. I can't help with that. You're probably going to still wake up pretty frequently, especially, you know, if you're breastfeeding. But when you are asleep, that you actually sleep better. So you have better sleep quality. And we know that better sleep quality is associated with better mental health overall. So when you're ready to talk about sleep in the postpartum period, and that could be very early on, or it could be much later in your postpartum journey, being physically active can help to support overall sleep quality.
That's huge. And I love that there's no like specific, you have to get 6 hours, or you have to get, you know, because like you said, that's not the reality for a lot of people. Yeah. It's still going to be broken up. Even if like I've thought about this, you know, we have friends who say, oh, I'm going to get a night nurse and I'm going to get help. And it's like, that's great. But it's like, are you going to have them for the full year? Because there's always going to be changes in sleep and, you know, things that are happening. So being able to prioritize what you can, which is all I could focus on. I'm still in that first year postpartum, right? So it's like, what can I focus on, which is the movement and the strength training and still getting that physical activity so that I can feel better later is, and I love that that's just kind of confirmed as well. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to pelvic floor training, what does that mean? Because I think as well in, you know, when we have been told, or it's even in movies and shows, it's just, oh, do all the Kegels and make sure you're doing your 100 Kegels a day. Are you doing it on a stoplight? Are you just doing your Kegels? And so is that what we're talking about here, or is it more expansive?
Yeah, so it is actually getting more expansive. At the most basic, simplest level, you can think about it as Kegels. But we now have really good research, which is demonstrating that pelvic floor muscle training that can go beyond, you know, just contracting those pelvic floor muscles and thinking about the other muscles that are surrounding as well, to be able to not only strengthen, but also to relax those muscles so that they function optimally, is going to be really important. So we do recommend that everybody see a pelvic floor specialist if that's possible. I live in Canada. We have lots of pelvic floor specialists right here in Edmonton. But when you get into the rural areas, it's not a common thing to have access to. And so we are starting to see different virtual options to be able to, you know, get some sort of instruction. And that even just those virtual options, learning more about pelvic floor, learning more about pelvic floor muscle training, can actually help to support overall pelvic health.
I think that's so massive, what virtual sessions and virtual, whether it's telehealth or whatever it may be, what that has brought to the access in rural communities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being able to, like you said, you're in Edmonton, we're near Los Angeles, we have a wealth of any type of provider we may be looking for, regardless of what the specialty is. But that's not the case. And sometimes we get lost in our own circumstance where it's like, oh, it's easy. We have 10 pelvic floor specialists within a few miles of here. Not the case for everybody. Mm-hmm. So flipping back to pregnancy, when someone is getting pregnant or coming into pregnancy, what types of screenings or tests might they want to be doing to understand if there is any modifications or if there is anything they should be keeping in mind when they're deciding what type of physical activity or exercise they want to do during their pregnancy?
So with our guideline consensus panel for the 2019 guideline, we actually ended up realizing that as we're going through this process that, you know, exercise is really quite beneficial, that there's we really didn't identify any harms for those who did not have contraindications to exercise. So those are medical conditions where exercise may not be recommended. So best practice is actually that you don't need broad, you know, medical clearance for every pregnant woman, but it's still really important that we screen for these contraindications. So we developed the Get Active questionnaire for pregnancy. So it is a self-completed screening tool that's designed to empower pregnant women to identify whether or not they do need to speak to their healthcare provider before beginning or continuing exercise in pregnancy. We developed the same thing for the postpartum period as well. So that would be the key screen that we do recommend, is to complete the Get Active questionnaire for pregnancy as soon as you become pregnant, just to double check. If you answer yes to any question, go speak to your healthcare provider. If you answer no to all of the questions, then you are free to continue your physical activity journey.
That's amazing. And we'll have that linked up in show notes too, so that people can get access to that questionnaire and better understand what we're talking about here. And now when it comes to the postpartum, like, is there individual recommendations that we should be providing? Like, say you came from a vaginal birth or you came from a cesarean birth, like, are there those individual things that we need to keep in mind when we're talking about getting back into movement?
Mm-hmm. So when we started the 2025 guideline, that was actually one of our key goals, was to be able to provide that individualized recommendations for post-cesarean and post-vaginal delivery. Probably one of the biggest disappointments that I had was that when we went into the research, because these are evidence-based guidelines, mm-hmm. there was virtually no information on what to do or you know, best practice for post-cesarean or post-vaginal delivery. The available information that we do have is that engaging in movement in those early days, especially post-cesarean section, is actually associated with improved recovery and healing. So that goes a little bit against what we've sort of traditionally thought, that with major abdominal surgery that we're having, you actually have to lie in bed. I was in bed for 3 days, didn't move, and I'm an exercise physiologist because that's what I was told to do. But the data suggests that you actually do want to be mobilizing. And if you think about any other major surgery, this is what we now recommend for all of our patients, is to get up and move. Often as soon as you're, you know, back out of the recovery room. So when we talk about cesarean section, early mobilization, but overall, what we do recommend is sort of that gentle movement early in the postpartum period, but not resuming moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity like that brisk walking or going for a run, until vaginal bleeding has slowed significantly or stopped. General healing has occurred. And then when you do resume, it does need to be a really gradual symptom-based progression. So you don't just jump in to, you know, a gentle walk one day and a 5K run the next day, that you do a slow progression back to physical activity that is guided by any symptoms that you're having.
I mean, I think that's really helpful, especially like when I've looked at other moms who have multiple kids, and it's like, if we're telling people, okay, don't move, don't do anything, how are they supposed to function when they do have other children they have to help and, you know, and be up and moving? So I think it helps. But then I've also heard of women getting back into like doing things even just around the house too soon and too quickly and opening up their scars. So how do we kind of go about the balance of start moving a little quicker, but then really understanding how to balance that a little bit more? So what are your kind of your recommendations with that?
Yeah. So those really early days, when I say movement, I literally mean like get up out of bed. Don't be afraid to shuffle to the bathroom. The data that we have is the equivalent of about 3,000 steps. But what we traditionally see with our women who have had a cesarean section is that they're told to stay in bed. We often have catheters for quite a while afterwards. But then when we are ready to resume, it's that gradual symptom base. So if you are experiencing an increase in pain, especially with your cesarean scar, if you're experiencing an increase in vaginal discharge or leaking overall, if you are restarting activity and it's too exhausting, you're just not recovering after that, probably just take it a little bit slower. But the reason that we don't have time-based or threshold-based recommendations is because everybody really is different and there is no evidence-based recommendation to say, well, you must be able to do this at 2 weeks postpartum and you must be able to do this at 8 weeks postpartum. Everybody's going to respond to certainly their labor and delivery, but those early postpartum days quite different.
I can't imagine the challenge in creating general recommendations for, as we've been saying, everyone has their own individual journey postpartum. And so I really love the how you include the symptom-based progression, because that's a great way to kind of catch every individual scenario. Like if you start doing something and have symptoms, whether it's at 2 weeks or 4 weeks, that's probably too much. And I think that's a great thing for people to keep in mind. And I know that, you know, we've been talking, are there any things that would be coming up that would be ultimate like contraindications for people? Any scenarios in postpartum that would be like, you really should be with a professional helping guide you through this?
So one of the key things that we did with the 2025 guideline is that we took a look at all possible contraindications, looking at other recommendations around the world. And what we found was that there was not really any consistency around the world. So I put together an international group. So there was our guideline consensus panel, but I also invited the leads for other major pregnancy postpartum guidelines from 7 different countries. We got together and we ran a study. We call it a Delphi study, but it's basically going through multiple rounds to identify what would be a key reason why you should not exercise during the postpartum period, or reasons why you would modify. At the end of the day, when we looked at the available evidence, there was not a single what we call absolute contraindication where being active postpartum would be potentially harmful. What we did find were relative contraindications. So those were conditions where you should go speak to your healthcare provider. But in the vast majority of conditions, we basically find that continuing some level of activity was beneficial, even if it's going to be a modification in terms of the intensity or duration or the type of activity that you're doing.
Okay, that's good to know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all so helpful. I feel like for people to feel like they have a bit more guidance, which is what guidelines are for, but understanding like what is safe for me and where do I need to get other help and seek advice elsewhere. I do want to go back into pregnancy a little bit more and talk about some of these taboo activities that we're constantly told, that's not safe, don't do that, that's going to harm your baby. Let's break into some of those. So some of them that, you know, I hear a lot is you shouldn't run if you're pregnant. Now, can we talk about running, even like high intensity exercise? So doing more like HIIT type training, you know, you're always told to do more low impact and make sure you're not raising your heart rate too much. And so when it comes to running and HIIT type activities where your heart rate is getting a little bit higher, what is the current evidence saying? And are there specifics that we need to be kind of concerned about in each different trimester?
Yeah, great question. We have this longstanding belief that, you know, when you're pregnant, you are potentially quite fragile. You know, if you think back like more than 100 years ago, most women were quite active during their pregnancies. At some point, that actually changed. And we see that with women and exercise. As a general rule, you know, it was, you know, just a bit past my lifetime where women were told that they should not run marathons because their uterus might fall out. And I feel like in some ways we've had a similar sort of stance in terms of pregnancy, where we actually had to prove safety before it would ever be recommended. So when we talk about things like running or high intensity interval training, HIIT training during pregnancy, this was really cautioned against for a very long time. Most of that is because the vast majority of the research that we had in the area was really focused on walking during pregnancy. And walking is a phenomenal activity. We see a 40% reduction in overall pregnancy complications when you are physically active. And most of that evidence is from walking. But for a lot of people, they want to do more than walking or yoga during pregnancy, especially when we talk about our athletic populations, our elite athletes who want to push hard and train hard. They had no guidance for that. So a couple of years ago, what we did is actually did the first high intensity interval training study. The key concern that we have is not concerned for the mom. We know, we think that the mom is actually going to be able to tolerate it really well. The key concern was whether or not the fetus could actually tolerate high intensity exercise. And really the only way that we know that is by directly measuring or using ultrasound to be able to measure fetal heart rate before and after the HIIT exercise. So we did that in the middle of COVID. We were wow. running a study, and I have never had such fast recruitment to a study. Everybody who came in was just like, I'm already doing this. I want to know if this is safe. So they came in, they did, high intensity interval training where their goal was to get maternal heart rate above 90% of maximal effort. We hit an average of 96% of maximal effort. And within these participants, we actually saw that the fetal heart rate was very stable throughout the exercise. We did not see any concerning responses. And what we found with that, and this has been repeated in other studies since we originally published this, that is quite well tolerated. When we talk about running, yes, there's lots of concerns. Certainly thinking about our pelvic floor health, I often hear on social media, oh, you can't run because you might jiggle the baby too much. But there's not any research that would actually suggest that. And in fact, what we find is that running during pregnancy is actually quite helpful, quite beneficial. We have data where we looked at athletes who they either continued to train throughout their pregnancy or they reduce their activity levels by 50% or more by the first or second trimester. What we found is that those athletes who continued to do things like running through pregnancy actually had a 50% reduction in pregnancy complications, mm-hmm. right? So it's, being active during pregnancy, especially if you're already doing it beforehand, can be actually really quite beneficial, not only for your physical health, but also for your mental health. And I think that's something that we forget about, is that many of us, run or play sports because it's good for our mental health. And that's how we handle with the stresses of daily life. You take that away, it can be quite problematic.
So, I mean, I've brought this up when we've talked with people who are in the area of research for pregnancy and postpartum before. I can't imagine, you've brought up a couple times, like the difficulty in finding good and high quality research. And it makes a lot of sense to me because a lot of ethics boards don't want to touch research on pregnant yes. women with the 10-foot pole because there's all the risks and the potential risks. Even if our hypotheses say this probably isn't going to pose any risk, like in the small chance that it does, that could, that's why there's such a lack of high quality pregnancy research. And so absolutely. I can definitely understand why there's been the hesitancy to do that. But then, as you're saying, once we do get these studies under our belt, we're like, oh, wow, it's actually beneficial. It's detrimental for these people to stop doing the activities that they love, which only makes too much sense because exercise seems to cure all. Exercise and movement just has benefit for all systems of the body. The other one that we definitely want to touch on, because I see these posts all the time on social media, is the mama who's in her third trimester and has the big belly and they're doing heavy deadlifts. And then you go and look in the comment section, and it's just atrocious what people are saying about this person. what is the take on heavy resistance training?
Ooh, great question. So I'm actually going to touch on both the ethics and resistance training. So the approach that we have actually had is, because you're absolutely right, it's unethical to be doing something that may potentially cause harm. But at the same time, we do need to know whether or not it's safe or healthful to be able to continue these activities. So the approach that I have taken is that I begin by doing surveys. They're not high quality data, but they are definitely important first steps to be able to identify whether or not there are potential harms or benefits of doing that particular activity. In the case of heavy weightlifting in pregnancy, we actually started by doing a survey of 690 women who lifted more than 80% of their 1RM. So basically, that means they're lifting heavy during their pregnancy. We separated out the data so that if they had maintained their lifting throughout pregnancy, or if they stopped lifting throughout their pregnancy, and or at least reduced significantly. So those people who continue to lift heavy throughout pregnancy, they had about a 50% reduction in the odds of having pregnancy complications. So that's a pretty major number.
That's huge.
And there's lots of, you know, we can get into the reasons for that. But what this actually led to was me being able to put this to my ethics board and say, you know, this is 690 people who are lifting heavy through their pregnancy. We're seeing that there are potential health benefits of doing that chronically throughout pregnancy, but we need to go in and do that direct assessment of fetal health and well-being before we can really start to recommend this being safe or not. And so that's actually what we did, is that we did do a follow-up study where we had women come in person, and we directly monitored fetal health. And again, we saw that the fetal responses were actually really well tolerating this heavy lifting, and that did include the deadlifts.
And how, like, to what degree were people lifting heavy?
Mm-hmm. So in that study, they were doing 90% of their 10RM. So that's equivalent to about 75% of maximal effort. We were not allowed to lift any heavier. However, we have just received ethics approval, and I'm just about later today, I'll be starting to advertise to have women in Edmonton come in if they've been lifting heavy during pregnancy. So more than 80% of their 1RM, we are going to actually directly test that. So exciting times. It's a stepwise progress. I think it's, you know, it takes a long time to do this, but I've got a long career ahead of me. I've got almost 20 years left. And so taking those stepwise approaches, make sure that we are, you know, doing best practice in ensuring that our moms are really quite safe and we're comfortable doing this type of work.
And you had touched on, you know, we could talk about the potential, like why those are, why it's so beneficial, why it could result in reduced pregnancy complications. Can we talk about the why?
Oh, sure. I'll try not to get too technical. So if it's, but we know that, you know, when you're lifting in pregnancy, you're going to maintain your muscle mass. And muscle mass is really, really critical for maintaining your insulin sensitivity during pregnancy. So if you slow down your activity, basically what can potentially happen is that your blood sugar levels will start to go up. If they go up too high, you can potentially have the development of gestational diabetes. There are other adaptations that happen to help support your blood pressure. Not during the lifting. So during weightlifting, your blood pressure will go up. This is a normal and natural response. But we see after you finish lifting, especially if you do it chronically, that your blood pressure levels can actually go down or just be maintained during pregnancy as well. So lots of, you know, phenomenal impacts overall.
Which are super huge. Those are like the two biggest concerns that women are experiencing is gestational diabetes and hypertension during pregnancy.
Exactly.
And so if we can have something that helps prevent that, it's massive. And especially with like getting the stress of like early delivery or induction or cesarean. And like, if we don't, again, have to worry about that and we can cut our risk in that, I think that's so, so, so valuable. Sorry, one other question I wanted to ask about just training in general during pregnancy. A lot of people are scared in first trimester because it's the fear of losing the baby. And do we have research that goes into talking about miscarriage? Does working out contribute to, you know, increasing our chances of having a miscarriage? Or what is the research on that?
Mm-hmm. So back in our 2019 guideline, we wanted to look specifically at miscarriage because this is the major reason why women don't exercise in the first trimester is because a number of years ago, there was this very large study that was published where they suggested that if you had higher levels of exercise in early pregnancy, that you did have an increased risk of having a miscarriage. Now, the one issue with that study that the authors acknowledged was that some people were interviewed about their training before they had a miscarriage and some were interviewed after they had the miscarriage. They went back a few years later. That study made, you know, major global headlines. It was really well published in the general media. But what they did is a couple of years later, they went back and they actually limited the data to only people who reported on their activity levels while they were still pregnant, first trimester. And then they saw no relationship. With the 2019 guideline, we did a systematic review. So we looked at all available literature. And we again looked at the impact of exercise in that first trimester on risk of having a miscarriage. We saw no increased risk at all. And we now have new data that is currently under review, which is looking at heavy weightlifting in the first trimester of pregnancy. So we followed more than 300 women and TBD, but it was also good looking.
It's so relieving because it is so common and it is so heart-wrenching. I've had a miscarriage myself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's something that no one wants to go through. And then the blame that it can be put on someone because, oh, well, was it because I was strength training? Was it because I was running still? Was it because, you know, we start to ask those questions to ourselves. So having this data is so valuable it mentally for women as well who are carrying that burden and that loss. So it's so incredibly supportive to be able to have this better understanding around pregnancy, miscarriage, loss, and the empowerment of what we could do to better help ourselves as well is just really incredible.
Yeah, being able to put a little more data behind detaching the blame or detaching the cause of these early miscarriages, because we know how prevalent they can be and that we really don't know what happens or what causes a lot of these spontaneous first trimester miscarriages. But flipping kind of back to the postpartum side of things, breastfeeding moms, I know that there can be, your body needs to do a lot to be able to provide the food and nutrients for this new growing baby that you have in your life. And exercise can impact that because exercise takes some of the energy that we're putting in. So do you have any recommendations for breastfeeding moms, especially those who might like or prefer a type of higher intensity or a calorically demanding type of exercise?
So the conversation about breastfeeding and exercise is really actually quite fascinating. So I'm a big proponent of fed is best. That being said, breastfeeding is beneficial certainly for the baby, but also for the mom. We know there's cardiovascular and potential mental health benefits as well. But we hear, especially from our higher level athletes, that many of them stop breastfeeding because they can't feel or they don't feel that they can sustain the breastfeeding while they're training at high levels. So we did do a systematic review looking at whether or not exercise impacts either breast milk quality or volume. And we didn't actually see any change in the composition of the breast milk. So the amount of protein, the amount of fat was maintained. But there are a couple of really important caveats that go with that. So one, breastfeeding is a significant caloric output. And so it's really essential that you sustain or that you feed yourself or fuel yourself to be able to sustain the breastfeeding, but also the training that you are planning to do. And then the second thing that we don't talk about enough is that you have to really stay well hydrated because that can definitely impact breast milk volume overall. So you know, we're not seeing an increased risk of injury overall. We're not seeing an increased or a change in breast milk quality or volume. But that really means that you do have to make sure that you are fueling yourself for both the breastfeeding and the activity and ensuring that you're well hydrated as well.
Huge. And something that I mean, just innately, even like sitting here, I didn't have breakfast this morning before our call, and I just hear my stomach growling at me because I'm still nursing and breastfeeding. So it's like your body will tell you. And, you know, I hear from so many women how hungry we are and how ravenous we need food. But especially with training, it is just so, so incredibly important. But also, you know, it's so nice for me to be able to focus on my strength no matter the other side of body composition or anything. Like, I can still get strong and feed my baby, which is, you know, the goal I think that a lot of women have. And I wanted to ask as well, you know, when it comes to birth, like, do we have research on certain types of exercise or what women are doing during pregnancy that helps to reduce birth complications and maybe shorten labors, or like, do we have any evidence on that, or is that just like so dependent, so individual? What can we say about those?
So when we talk about exercise during pregnancy, like I said, most evidence that we have is based on sort of walking, brisk walking, maybe a little bit of a lighter jog. Less information about the higher intensity activities and less information about cycling or, you know, swimming, that sort of thing. And so what we found with our 2019 guideline is that just engaging in brisk walking throughout pregnancy reduces your risk of having preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, gestational hypertension by 40%. We see a 67% reduction in the odds of having depression as well. But what we haven't talked about enough, and you sort of touched on it a little bit, is when we talk about the postpartum period, we have had this like really strong sort of bounce back culture for such a long time. But being physically active postpartum is really not about, you know, going back to your pre-baby weight. What we really focus on is sort of moving forward into the next part of your journey, and that we're actually seeing huge benefits for your mental health. We see a 45% reduction in depression postpartum, especially if you resume physical activity in those first 12 weeks, which is probably when it's also the hardest. We see a 28% reduction in the odds of having type 2 diabetes in the postpartum period as well. And then engaging in pelvic floor muscle training, we're seeing a 37% reduction in the risk of having urinary incontinence. So these physical activity guidelines are really not about, hey, let's, you know, get back to where we were before we were pregnant, because pregnancy and childbirth completely change us. Having a new baby, we're a different person than we were before. And so the focus is really on health rather than body composition or weight.
So important.
So everything we've been talking about is amazing. Guidelines are great. Putting out guidelines is one thing. Adoption, we kind of mentioned this earlier, adoption in the medical practice is a whole nother ball game. And so I guess I have a couple questions. Like, what are you guys doing to encourage adoption of these practices and of recommending these guidelines in current OBGYN offices or birthing centers? And what can a patient do or a pregnant mom do if they're in a room and they encounter an OB that seems to be giving them outdated advice?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the toughest part, is certainly we call it implementation. And there's lots of, you know, methodological research that shows how you can best implement guidelines, but it is it's an absolute slog. There's no question. When we started the guideline, we wanted to have all of the key players who support pregnant and postpartum women in the room. So certainly we had our OBGYNs, we had our midwives, our physios, our sports medicine physicians, our qualified exercise professionals, and then we had the voice of the moms themselves as well. So having that broad representation in the guidelines is very helpful. because our different organizations in Canada then go on to adopt them. Now, adopting and endorsing guidelines, you're absolutely right, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to end up right in your doctor's office. And so there's lots of different ways that we're trying to help support that. So increasing awareness through newsletters and webinars. I send out infographics to absolutely every OBGYN and midwife in Canada after the 2019 guideline was released. Very expensive, but I heard that there are lots of these posters that are up, and I get asked about the posters all the time. But then we also, we really need to focus on getting, right to the people who are going to be affected the most. So that's our pregnant and postpartum women. And so I have my Instagram where I'm trying to put out really easy to understand, easy to digest, short bits of information. I'm doing podcasts, speaking to people like you to raise awareness and give the information so that if you do go into your doctor's office and they are telling you, well, you shouldn't exercise above 140 beats per minute, which is something that was, presented in 1985 and reversed just a couple of years later, but we still hear about that, that you can then go and say, actually, there's new information and this is where you go to get it.
Yes. Yes. And we're going to have all of that linked up as well so that people can find you. That's exercise and pregnancy, right?
Yes.
With periods
One word, exerciseandpregnancy.ca.
Perfect. Yes. On Instagram, I follow you guys. Incredible information. You really do make it very digestible for people to be able to see and share and get that information across. Because I think even like share the information, if you have a family member telling you, you shouldn't be doing this, just share it on your story. Hope that they see it. it's such valuable information. Where are you guys looking into research next? Like, where do you think the gaps are? Where do we need to still go in research in pregnancy and postpartum?
So a lot of the work that I'm doing right now is looking at what I would call the extremes of exercise in pregnancy, and that goes on both ends of the spectrum. So I'm leading the upcoming International Olympic Committee guideline for athletes who are preconception, pregnancy, and pregnant and postpartum. So trying to build the research and recommendations around that. But then at the opposite end of the spectrum, we have women who have contraindications. So they are told that they, shouldn't be engaging in moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity because of potential harms to either the health of themselves or to the baby. But the research behind some of those recommendations needs to be improved. And so we have a really active research program looking at moms who have twin pregnancies, moms who have congenital heart disease, to try and understand if there is some level of activity that is beneficial, or if the recommendation to sort of reduce and avoid as much as possible is the most appropriate. So we have, we have a lot of information sort of in the middle for going for a walk, that sort of thing. But at the high intensity, longer duration exercise, and for those women who have contraindications to exercise, we have such little information at the moment. So those are the two places we're really working on right now.
Amazing.
The one thing that I've learned the more and more research I ever read is that we need to do more research regardless of the area of study. And we appreciate you so much for doing that in this space especially. And I really loved the way that you outlined the stepwise process of making sure that everything you do is safe and ethical and beneficial and research that we truly need. And just the work that you guys do is obviously amazing. And the guidelines that you're coming out with are a reflection of that. Thank you so much for coming and sharing all of this knowledge. And we hope that there are people out there that are listening that are finding this beneficial or know somebody that they can share this with. Where else can those people go to continue to learn more from you or from these guidelines and the research?
So in addition to our website, exerciseandpregnancy.ca, I've been really trying to do a lot more work on Instagram. So Instagram is at Dr. Margie Davenport, and that's where you're going to see the latest information as it comes out. But Perfect. Thank you so much for having me. I think it's really important the voices that you have to be able to share these stories and share this information. We know that there's a gap between research being published and 13 years to getting it into the general public. So you're really instrumental and helpful for sharing that information. So thank you.
We're doing our small little part here and hoping that it reaches more people. So
it's huge.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Margie. Thank you so much for sticking around for another interview. Margie was an absolute wealth of knowledge when it comes to exercise during the pregnancy and postpartum stages of life. If you know somebody out there who might be in this phase and would benefit from this podcast, please pass this along. If you haven't, please consider leaving a rating and review on your favorite podcasting platform. And of course, we will see you next time on the Optimal Body Podcast.